Yes, great. So this is Anna Siegel here with Anna Levy. It's Tuesday, November 17th, and we have already had different ways of describing this moment. I thought it was semi-post-apocalypse, and Anna Siegel said it's just the intermission. So here we go. This is round three of Education Narratives interviews, and let's just begin. You know, I read a bit through some of your, you know, the notes from the past interviews, and what I caught wind of was a big decision moment, I guess, or several. I'm thinking over the summer and into the fall on whether or not you would continue along the same lines that you had been continuing with the playgroup. And I'm just kind of wondering where you landed on that decision, and also how has the universe of your decisions changed over the last couple of months since school has started again?
I think I am really aware right now of the incredible, what feels like external pressure or inertia to just like keep doing things the same way that they have been done before, and to do that like in defiance very much of like all of the forces that are making it way more difficult and way more like counterintuitive, you know, that the way that things have been done previously, all the things should be, or like would be more naturally done differently right now than they have been before. And that just isn't the way things are going. So, you know, I'm in this like funny, weird, very surreal moment at RHP right now, where today I gave my first like Zoom tour for the 2021-2022 school year, which, you know, this is in fact like almost a month later than I would have started those last year. And obviously they would have been in person, and it, you know, and I pushed far. Lots of people started them. Lots of, you know, are like friendly competitors, but competitors started them a month ago, right on time. And I was just like, I can't, like, I don't know enough. And I am still deciding about this year. We can't decide yet about next year. And I don't think families are best served by making a decision now about something that's going to be so murky for so much longer. But there's, you know, I mean, all of these structures that are in place about when tuition starts coming in and how you make hiring decisions for teachers who are on a year-long contract if you don't know how much tuition is coming in, and all of these things. And because there has been so little, you know, funding or cushion and, you know, to our schools, but also to families, like everybody is just like, gotta keep going, gotta keep doing the thing we're doing, because if we don't keep on the hamster wheel, then we're all the way off the hamster wheel. And I've just been really, so that's sort of where we are right now as a school, is a real push and pull, I think, for me, for our board, for our teachers, for our families, the whole community, I think, feels it, between needing to keep moving forward and to keep doing things and to keep acting as though the next step is the next step, while also like really needing to rethink the present and address what is not working about the present and what is like too hard about it. And it, you know, it's really tricky and really bizarre, because, you know, I think of myself as a person and like my leadership of the school as in general, pretty tied to reality and pretty able to say, like, this is what we need to do. And this is how we're going to do that. And like, if there's a need, we're going to address it and we're going to try to plan ahead. And there is zero appetite for that right now. Like, nobody wants to hear me say, you're not going to get a child portfolio or a report card that looks the same as the one you would have normally gotten this coming June. They'll be happy to hear that in June, but they don't want to hear it right now. And so teachers who are like, we actually cannot write them in the way that we've always written them because our work is different and we are more tired and it is more time consuming. And like, we're now spending an hour a day spraying down tabletops when we would have normally had that time to do something else. Are like in this position, these teachers, of either just go ahead, put in more time, scramble way harder than you've ever scrambled before to do the thing in the way that it has always been done, or just don't do it, which is probably not an option, or rethink it and reinvent it. But there's no time for the rethinking and reinventing. So it's just like, cobble together something else instead of really thoughtfully approach this time and do the thing that makes sense for this time. And I think, so that's where I am right now, is this real, like, I think a thing that is special about our school, I think that a thing that is special about education when it's done well and educational institutions that do it well, or that they, like, the time and the thought are a piece of the work and that you don't just like go on autopilot. And so I'm really trying to build time and thought and space for time and thought into this thing in which it's just like react, move forward. But I'm really like struck by that right now. And that is where we are, is this real push between this like super capitalist, like the 40-hour work week and the tuition has been paid, so the kids have to be in school for the same amount of time. And what's going to happen if we go remote and we're not care anymore? We're just like, quote unquote, education. And what's the difference between those things anyway? But also that you can tell the difference if your toddler is in your house versus if your toddler is not in your house. And then, so like, there's this whole like capitalist push. And then there is this like counterforce around the work that we do, where it is like, somehow, despite the fact that early childhood education in this country is not like funded or treated as a human right, that people feel that it is, and I feel that it should be. But so people don't want to like pay more for more work in it and more money that it is taking to run a program. So there's just like really, really contrasting push and pull oppositional forces working on our school right now. And I think they're working, I think that that's a pretty universal feeling right now of sort of simultaneously having to move forward and only having the way it's been done before and not having the time to make a new way, really. But it stinks.
Are there conversations, like specific conversations you can think of that stand out that you've had with teachers or folks who are in the middle of this hustle where there's just no time to rethink anything? And then on the other hand, conversations that you've had with parents that stand out along the lines of some of what you were just saying?
I mean, I think this question about writing portfolios has been really an active question with my teachers for the last month or so. And we've really, my thinking has shifted. The teachers are really good and strong advocates for themselves and for the children. And I think like are often able to say, you know, our interests are the interests of the children, which I know to be true, right? Like if your teachers aren't fine, then your classroom's not fine. And So the teachers have been sort of saying, like, we don't have the same amount of time to write these things, which we are a special thing that we've always done. And they're very much sort of above a standard. They take a lot of work, and it's ongoing work, and it's really a lot of writing about every child, and they're very individualized. And they're sort of an ongoing project throughout, like over the course of a whole year. So it's not even like one of these things where you could just be like, we're going to take a day off in the spring, you're going to all write them. It's like, no, you have to build this in every week, every day, all year long. So, you know, at the beginning of the year, we said maybe, you know, maybe portfolios will look different, but we don't really know that yet because we don't really know what this year is going to look like yet. We don't know how much in person we're going to have. We don't know how, you know, we don't know if we're going to be remote. We're going to, you know, let portfolios do what we have always tried to have them do, which is really reflect the experience of the child and the growth of the child. And whatever that experience is, we're going to reflect it in writing. And so we said that. And then, you know, we were all like shocked and delighted to have two continuous months of great in-person school at the beginning. Nobody, I think, expected that that would go as smoothly as it did. And so it was like, maybe portfolios don't have to look that different. You know, it feels as though maybe we're sort of back to school and the routines of being back at school. Maybe that's one that can just, you know, live the way it was and we don't have to put the time in to rethink it because I think they're good. And we all thought they were good. They are good. But then there just came to be this point of teachers saying, we don't have the time. Like, we have the in-person school, but we don't have the time anymore to write these things. And like, what do you want them to be instead? And I was just like, I have no idea, you know, I don't know. And what do you want them to be? What do you think is, you know, and so we are making the space for this conversation of like, what is important about these as documents, you know, and if there are parts of them that are going to have to be shed, what do we want to keep? Like, what's their essential function? And we sort of have had, you know, as a staff come to the understanding of sort of dual functions, like one being that ongoing writing and reflection about a child informs your teaching in a way that's important to us. And, you know, that sitting down weekly and thinking really specifically about one child and the way that they're working really makes you a better teacher to that child than, you know, sort of saving it all up for writing it in May and then forming your hypothesis about that child. So we wanted the sort of ongoing thinking piece. And then the other thing that we really have decided that we feel is really important is like a document or an artifact that helps families really understand who their child is as a learner. And so, you know, we're getting rid of some of the extraneous parts. Like they'll probably be a lot less visually appealing than they have been in past years. They'll probably include less beautiful language around academic skills development, because like that's something that doesn't necessarily need the beautiful language in the same way that an illustration of who a child is in a social emotional capacity, for example, like that really needs the like nuanced language. But we can also just say like he knows all 26 letter sounds, you know, and we don't need to like necessarily write that in a really, really beautiful way. Or illustrate that with a meaningful anecdote, which is what we would have normally done. And I think there's value in that, but we're having to sort of say like the, you know, pare it down, like what's the most important parts and how do we take some of the time back? So that is the conversation that's been like ongoing and hard. And really, I have to say really hard for me as a human. And as the boss of people that I very much like respect and admire and whose practice I think is really good and who I also have been like, my instinct is like, let's just work more and do them not necessarily the way they've always been done, but to the absolute fullest that we can do them. Because, like, to me, it doesn't feel fair that these kids don't get them. And that their families don't get them. And that, like, after all of the shit that they have lost and had to go through, that they also, like, don't get this, like, special thing that they would normally get that's so beautiful and amazing. And I know that what we create will be beautiful and amazing, but, like, the letting go of some of that, like, perfectionism and specialness has been really hard for me. But I know that the teachers are right and that I am wrong on that. So that's one side of the conversation. And then the other side that you asked about of, like, the families and the tuition. And I mean, there have been so many. And our families are great and, like, they're very on board. And I think we're having, in many ways, a much easier, like, tuition conversation as a community than many school communities are having. But we have one family who's enrolled. This is their first year at the school. So they didn't have the same, like, familiarity with us, trust in us, you know. I mean, they just don't know us as well as many of our families who are returning families do. But their child was enrolled for our youngest classroom, continues to be enrolled, and hasn't started yet because she was going through chemo and so is immunosuppressed and wasn't able to start until, like, her scans were cleared and blah, 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 which, like, first was going to be, you know, mid-September and then is now probably December 1. But so, you know, I've had a conversation with this family that's just an ongoing conversation from May or whenever we started the tuition conversation with families, and this was before her diagnosis, of, you know, are we in or are we out? And, you know, if we're in, then we're in. And, like, it's a commitment. And if you're committing to hold the spot, then you're committing to pay the tuition. And here is why. And it means paying teachers and it means running a program. And that's why. And it's your decision. And it's a question mark for every family, but you have to decide and then you have to stay decided. And we just keep having this conversation with this family. And I'm like, the answer is the same, you know? And you have a very special circumstance, and I want to be as accommodating and reasonable and helpful and, like, realistic and kind about that special circumstance as I can. And I don't want to, like, screw the family out of a toddler with cancer out of $25,000. Like, that's not my end goal here. But if you can't decide about whether you want to take the spot, you can't be enrolled in the spot, you know? And at some time there is a decision and you just have to make it. And, like, either way is fine. And we will treat you, like, according to policy and in the best, you know, the best possible faith, no matter which way. And there's no pressure on either end, but, like, we can't reopen this conversation every 4 weeks of, like, what's the tuition policy? Like, the tuition policy is the tuition policy, and it was the tuition policy, and it remains the tuition policy. And if you want to withdraw her, withdraw her, you know? And there's this sort of, that piece is the piece of, that I'm really having trouble understanding in terms of the parent perspective of, like, the facts remain the facts, right? Like, the facts are just the facts about what's happening in the world and what's happening in early childhood and what our policy is and all of this. And there does seem to be just, like, a difficulty on all sides, which is, I think, very reasonable. And I certainly have this difficulty myself of just, like, digesting the moment and, like, absorbing all the facts. You know, it just keeps being a conversation not about, like, what's our interpretation of the facts or how are we going to respond to the facts or anything, but, like, what are the facts again? Like, could you just lay out this landscape again? And I think that, you know, speaks, I think, that speaks to these contrasting pressures that are in some ways, I think, just impossible to reconcile and navigate, and that the piece of, like, when we see the whole picture, we see things that are actually totally incompatible with one another. And so we have to just keep being like, is that actually what the picture is? And sort of those are that's the tone of the conversations right now.
Just taking a couple of notes. You mentioned that the first 2 months of school felt really normal. So what does that entail? What were the classrooms like? How were the days running? What was normal about it? And I guess what changed after 2 months?
Yeah. I mean, it still feels normal. And I think when I said it felt normal, what I meant was like, we were in school full time and nobody got COVID and we didn't have to shut down and go remote. And, you know, we were just like continuously every day in our school building. And in some ways it did feel normal, like other years, like the kids are still kids and their development is still their development, and the things on the shelves and the things in the classrooms and the conversations and the songs and the materials are the same things in the classroom and conversations and songs and materials. It did not feel normal to do this work in this time. And I think that one of the things that we as a staff have been trying to articulate to families, and I think that families also very much feel, is that it is as though like coming to school is going into a portal into a totally different universe. And it's like school in so many ways exists in a way that it did a year ago. And like you go and there are crayons and there's lunch and there's, you know, easels and reflection meetings and these things. And then you go, the rest of your life is totally unrecognizable. And that sort of like back and forth into and out of the twilight zone every day really felt, and like a little less so now for me, I don't know how other people are, really felt draining, like trying to maintain this thing that in the best of times is hard work, you know, running a school and being a teacher and, you know, doing something with little kids that is like really meaningful and forward moving and rich takes a lot of energy in the best of times, but then doing it in this environment and trying to like turn the energy on and turn the energy off and, you know, have an experience that is worthwhile and then go home and re-enter a world in which so much is so fraught was really like emotionally draining. And I think in some ways emotionally damaging. It feels a little better post-election. I think like there was a definite wind up of like really bad energy before that. And we were all just a mess. And I think now we're like, a little bit looser. It's still hard, but a little bit looser.
What were the three, let's say the, you know, 2 to 3 weeks leading up to the election like?
They were really tense, really tense. I've been the director there, 4 years, 5 years? And before that, I was a teacher and I taught with many of these teachers, like as a colleague. And they are, I also, because I arrived at RHP from having lived abroad. They were my first friends in New York this go around. Like, they're my friends. And it's the first time, those 3 weeks, it's the first time in the whole time that I've worked there where, like, I really felt tension from the staff towards me. A feeling of, like, people just being like, the demand of this job is too much. Which I think, like, made sense to me in certain ways. And I think that the demand of this job in the like umbrella sense of being an educator right now, definitely too much. I was sort of surprised to feel that people like felt that about RHP particularly, and less like just the demand of being an educator right now is just too much in general. But I think like, you know, we work really hard and it was a reasonable feeling. And some of it is like related to the portfolios and all of these things, these conversations that are ongoing in which the teachers are advocating and saying what they know to be true, which is useful. But so there was like that kind of tension. There was like a, just a feeling of what will happen if it all goes to hell, and like at what point, I think it was on all of our minds, like, is there a point at which this work no longer is meaningful? You know, like, do you come back to work? Do you, like, are you more needed and better used elsewhere? And if you think, as I think most of us at RHP do, if you think of like early education as work that is driven by like social responsibility and a sort of particular philosophy and worldview about like helping and advocating and social justice and those kinds of things, then like what is the moment at which you're like, this, like, this work isn't the most important work I could be doing in this particular important moment? And I was sort of terrified of having to make that call. We ended up, we were closed the day after Election Day. We took a community mental health day, which was, I think, a really good decision and like much needed. And when we got back, you know, even before the election was called, like there was a sort of collective sigh of relief of just like, there hasn't been this convulsion of like mayhem in the streets that was possible or felt possible. And you know, we can still be here and we still know what the work is that we do and why it's important to us. So that definitely felt better, but the 2 weeks were miserable. Just everybody was mad at each other and scared of what was going to happen and so tired and so stressed and icky feeling.
Are the students old enough to ask questions, to like, are they processing what is happening? You know, is COVID weird to them? Do they know something is different? Did they detect all of this energy around the election? Like, how are the students interacting and how are teachers interacting with them?
So it's funny, you know, we're an early childhood program. Our kids are between 2.5 and now like 5.5. So there's a real wide span, right? Like the 2.5-year-olds have no idea. Like they're going to be, you know, fluent mask wearers. That's the culture in which they have grown up. And I'm sure that there's going to be interesting developmental differences about like the ways they communicate with their faces and their bodies, and the, you know, their ability to read facial expressions is going to be a little bit different probably. And you know, they're gonna compensate because their brains are so plastic and like this is what they're seeing as the way language is. And so they have no idea, you know, and their teachers, I think, feel very much that their classroom is a refuge and a place where they can just like be in their own little classroom community that's pretty like insulated and isolated and its own little bubble. And then there's, you know, so that's the 2s and 3s. And then there's a middle group that's pre-K, and they notice and they remember and they can remember, you know, most of them are returning students. So most of them like remember when we were in school before COVID and remember stopping coming to school and doing remote learning and like know that they didn't always wear masks and that there are some different rules. And then our oldest kids are kindergarten and they truly know. And like, you know, most of those kids also have been at our school now for 3 years. And so know us and know that there are all these new rules and different ways of being. And, you know, one of them, every time I see him, which is, you know, every day, it's not a big school. I see them all every day. He's like, you can still go in all the classrooms and you're the only one.
He says, it's true. You can what?
You can still go in all the classrooms.
Oh, wow.
You're the only one. And it is true. I am the only one. And, you know, he's just like so interested in that. And they were fascinated by the election and their teachers. I mean, I like so admire them and I so pity them. And I don't know how they have the energy for it because they're also having to do, you know, they're teaching George Floyd and they're teaching, you know, herd immunity and like having to answer these huge questions in kid-friendly language while they're so tired and so drained. And like these kids are just like, tell us more, like tell us more, give us more, please. You know, and they're just, I mean, they're right now, these kids are all about like indigenous land rights and like learning from traditional indigenous like land preservation practices and like, you know, controlled burn and all of like how water supplies are, you know, fairly allocated to communities. And their teachers are just like, oh man, like these are big, 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 big ideas. And they're so hard and they're so urgent and kindergartners are not going to wait. And like, they're hearing it all and everything that's in the ether. It just like, they hear it and they grab it and they're like, tell me everything. You know? And so it's a really different feeling. I mean, I think all of the classrooms are going really well and it's like really rich and really appropriate what's happening in there. But there's a marked difference at like these different developmental stages of, you know, from the little ones who feel like so sheltered from what's going on to the big ones who in some ways are like at the peak of, there are no walls. Like the world is your classroom and the classroom is your world. And like, there's no distinction between those two things, which as you get older again, like there is, you know, as you get older, it's like, we're going to chat about this for 10 minutes, but now open the Great Gatsby. And like, that's what we're doing. But kindergarten, it's not like that. It's just like the world is your classroom. And like, what a classroom it is right now.
How do you prepare for staff meetings or how do you, you know, how do you game plan these days?
I wish I did. I wish I could. I mean, the time crunch is so real and is just so stupid and so like brutal and so much of the stuff that I am doing has to do with like, let's stay on our schedule from previous years and let's adapt instead of let's just like let it all burn to the ground and invent something that works for right now. And that just like is the way it is. I don't think it could be different without really risking like the lives and livelihoods of a lot of people. And so I think that's like a worthwhile effort. But the game plan, like the conversations that we could have as a staff about like, what should we be talking about and how should we be talking about it? And like, what do they want to know? And how do we learn more about how to talk about these things? And you know, all of those kinds of things that normally we would be spending tons of time on collectively, and I would be spending a lot of time and resources and energy on learning about so that I could help teachers, you know, help direct people to useful resources. Like, there's no bandwidth for that right now. So, you know, I've been trying really hard. And I think that like October really reminded me that the teachers needed more of my energy and attention. And I just think of them as like so confident and so amazing and so trusted that I just wasn't necessarily thinking about like structuring their work for them. Like they were being supported in a lot of ways, but it wasn't necessarily like all the right ways or all of the ways that they needed. And so I've been, you know, paying more attention to like what conversations do I think they want to have and how do we have those while also respecting the fact that they are under tremendous time crunches. And, you know, they also keep saying like, we need more time and we don't have any more time. And also we really want to meet and have these conversations. And I'm like, well, you gotta pick, you know, like these things are in conflict. And like everything else, we got to just like make a choice. And the choice that works for you isn't going to be the choice necessarily that works for your co-teacher, that works for, you know, your teaching partner, whatever. And we've got to sort of like try to all come to some sort of consensus about how it's going to be. But I don't know. It's hard. I think like the biggest thing that I'm trying to do in terms of game planning for teachers and structuring those conversations is returning to methods of conversation starting that I think are meaningful to our staff. So like bring a piece of documentation from your classroom and present it with no qualitative description. Just show us the thing and tell us what happened. And then like, let's open a conversation around that, that like really tries to only be descriptive as opposed to assigning value. You know, that kind of sort of open-ended start of like, really like, let's root ourselves in the experience and the moment and like what actually happened, and then let's interpret it in the many different ways it could be interpreted, is a way that we work a lot and that we are all like familiar with and buy into. So like trying to remember that we can do that and to make space for doing that instead of being like, I have about 4,000 things to tell you and I know we all want to go home and like let me just read you my list. You know, and it's a hard, and it's like a hard impulse when we're all running so fast.
Yeah.
To be like, we're gonna really try to slow down here and have a conversation. It's hard.
Anna, can you excuse me for
2 minutes? Thank sure.
You. I will be right back. So two other things that I can hear coming up and I want to ask you about. One is, you know, the actual shortfall in the budget from what it sounds like is needed on, you know, a regular day. But then where are, you know, how are you making decisions about the budget and where are the things that need the most, but you know, there are no resources for that are different from previous years. And then the other thing that I want to ask you about, you can choose, you know, which one to start with, is really just about grief, you know, and loss. Like people are mourning so many different things that they can and can't name at the same time. And I was just curious if you could talk about how that's showing up in your work personally, professionally, how teachers are talking about it, how students are talking about it. So either one.
Yeah. Well, let's do grief. Because
I see what you did there.
I mean, I think the grief thing is so real. And, you know, it is so personal. Many of us now, like, have had personal losses that have come out of this. And many of us have also, like, experienced big, hard life moments. One of my teachers is, like, in the middle of a very sad breakup from her live-in boyfriend, or, you know, things like that. My father was, like, hospitalized and has lost a, you know, not from COVID, but, like, has had a real decline in his health and well-being. And, like, we can't see them, you know, and, like, she can't see her family. I haven't seen my parents. Like, but being in school is the reason for that. And that is hard. And is, I think, a piece of the demand on educators that's so hard right now, is, like, there's just not enough good science yet to believe that, like, we can still be moving in the general population in the same way that people who are working from home are, for example. And so a lot of us are, like, really, you know, taking our work as pretty high risk work, even though, you know, maybe it's not. And, like, the spread in schools has been so much less than many of us anticipated it would be or expected it would be. So it's, like, very isolating personally to do this work that is very connected socially in the classroom. And I think that, you know, obviously, like, personal isolation and grief are not, like, a super great combination. So I think, you know, I see that in my teachers. I see how tired people are. I see, you know, I know, because I know this staff pretty well and, you know, have known them well personally for a long time, I can see the different ways that grief shows up for different people. You know, I'm a person who gets really irritable and cranky when I'm deeply, deeply sad. We have teachers who just, like, get sort of classically Eeyore-esque depressed. We get, you know, we have teachers who just sort of shut down and don't want to connect in the same ways that they might otherwise. And so I see those things and I know that they are there and we talk about them in terms of, like, what do you need, and take care of yourself and, like, take your days off and do the things that you need to do. And what does self-care even look like right now? Who knows? Is it a myth? Who knows? But, like, do the things that make you feel good and, like, listen to your needs. And, like, when I'm being unreasonable about what the demands should be or, like, what we can as a staff accomplish, like, say that and I'll try not to, like, bite your head off. And, you know, like, let's, like, try together as much as we can to build something that's going to, like, work for us and sustain us right now through this time. I think, you know, the kids, like, it's such a cliche to say it, but, like, the kids are amazing and a huge part of this is that, like, if they weren't, it wouldn't work. And that, like, if the thing about teaching wasn't that kids are amazing and classrooms are amazing and the work is incredible, then, like, we'd all be somewhere else doing something else, because, like, we would not be doing this. So it was funny, you know, we had one of our three-year-olds yesterday came into school, and they all have to say goodbye in this, like, very abrupt way at the door. Like, their parents just sort of push them in, and there's, you know, socially distanced, whatever, and then we're all used to it now. And, you know, she's a returning child. She was in our twos class last year. And she, for whatever reason, she had a really rough morning drop off. And she was, you know, really, like, screaming and shrieking when she was dropped off and was passed into her teacher. And there are 1,000 million steps getting them, like, into school now, of, you know, the the temperature taking and the sanitizer and change into your indoor shoes and go wash your hands and, you know, all this, all weather gear, all this stuff. So in any case, teachers don't have time for that kind of thing at the door right now, like a big tantrum. So I took her into my office. And, you know, she's a kid that I, you know well from a year already. And we, you know, like each other and get along great. And she screamed it out for a little while. And then she told me what was wrong. And then she wanted to just like hang out and calm down in my office a little bit. And, you know, on one of the bulletin boards in my office, there are, you know, pictures and cards that people have given me and drawings people have made and things. And there was posted up like a little, you know, holiday, like gift card tag that one of the kids from her class last year, the family had had his like school picture printed on gift enclosures and given them to us for holiday something. And I had posted it up and she was, you know, hanging out in my office and looking around and she goes, "Oh, huh. I see a picture." And I said, "Yeah, you know him. Who is that?" And she goes, "Oh no, I used to know him. There are lots of people I used to know."
Oh.
And I was just like, whoa. And then, you know, it's so funny because they're so little. And I couldn't tell if that was a huge moment of COVID grief and like your class was your class and then wasn't your class anymore and like they were gone and you never saw him again. Or if that was just a thing that a three-year-old says about a kid who's no longer in our school, right? Like, I don't know. But it was an amazing thing to say and an amazing way for her to say it. And I think I know that there is that for some of them and probably more for the older ones than some of the younger ones, but that piece of like there was a thing, and even though we're back and many of us are back in the same place with a pretty familiar group of people, not everyone's back and not everyone, you didn't get to say goodbye to everyone. And as much as we tried to really like be thoughtful about the ways we helped them to process and help them to understand what was happening and tried to facilitate as many different ways of saying goodbye and marking time and all of that as we could, it was totally inadequate to like what the need was for that. So yeah, I think there's a lot of grief and I think that it will come out as it does with little kids always through, you know, it'll come out more and more as their language develops more and more and as their like fluency with materials develops more and more. The little kids have like a real challenge in terms of expressing grief because they're not as expressively fluent as older children. Yeah.
Can you tell me, walk me through the actual process of entering the building?
Sure. So we have two entrances that face the street. One class uses one of them, two classes use the other, and those two classes that share the hallway entrance are like on a staggered schedule. So it's one class at a time per door. The way it works, on the sidewalk, there are, you know, social distancing markers, like stickers on the street. And you, as a child, walk up or scoot up with your parent. The parent stands on the social distancing marker. Usually there's a short line, two or three people. I'll stand at a door, another teacher or administrator will stand at the door. When it's your turn, we'll call. When it's the child's turn, we'll call the child's name. And they'll come over. And they're, you know, they're constantly, they're like so little. And they have all this junk to carry now, because it's just like, you have to have all sorts of weather gear because everybody's going outside every day, no matter what. And like, just all this stuff. And, you know, now we don't serve snack, you bring your snack. And just all of these like little things that like really add to the amount of stuff that they're carrying. So they're so like laden. They look as though they're going like camping for a month. But they, you know, come on over and they get their temperature taken with a contactless thermometer, and they get their hands sanitized, and I'll chat with them just a little bit, make sure that they're fine. And then their parent will check them in on an app. And then they go into the classroom, or, you know, so the two classes that use the hallway entrance walk down this like long hallway. And then they're in the cubby area and a teacher meets them there. And then the other class just goes directly into their cubby area where they're met by a teacher. And then they sort of unpack themselves. So they like put the snack in the snack bin and the lunch in the lunch bin and take off their jackets and on hat and on mitten and on scarf and all of the things, which those are hard jobs for really little kids. And then they change into indoor shoes. And then after doing those things, they're ready to go wash their hands. So they go to the bathroom and they wash their hands and do like the 20 seconds and the suds and all of this. And then they're in. That's how they get in. And they do that at the beginning of the day. And then they do sort of the reverse of that at the end of the day. And they also do it whenever they go outside, which is all the time. And they're so good about it and like cheerful about it. And their poor teachers just like can sit there for half an hour while 15 2-year-olds try to change their shoes by themselves and like be so nice about it. And I would never be able to do it. I'm in awe of these teachers.
What have you learned from this, you know, I guess from before and after, not before and after, sorry, there's a holiday coming up. Is there any kind of like big proactive change? You know, you're like, oh, I'm going to do that. That one thing is going to be the thing that we do differently when you have 5 minutes to breathe.
I am really aiming. So the Thanksgiving break, we have 5 days. And I'm really aiming to not work. I don't know if that's like a realistic possibility. But even if I didn't work for 3 and like did a full work day for 2 of them, that would be the longest that I haven't worked since like late February when this all started being a thing. And I feel really, really, really committed to that as a work project. Like, as a, like, I know that I am nearing like a dangerous point of burnout and not being able to make myself do the things I need to do. And of not being able to like maintain the kind of like kindness and compassion and patience and like, ability to explain what's happening and to communicate. I mean, the communication demands are just like so insane. And like, you have to say so much and you have to say it over and over again. And it has to be timely and it has to be all these different ways that are so like these demands. And like, this does not exist in male dominated fields, that like you have to say these things but you also have to say them really nicely. And it is so tiring. Like, I am so tired of being nice about things and being like rooting the things that are just like, it's a fact. You have to put your kid in a mask. You have to show up on time. We can't tolerate late kids this year. It ruins everything. And I want to just say, like, it ruins everything. And I'm wasting my time when I spend 15 minutes standing with your kid while they do all their jobs because you couldn't be on time. Right. And like, saying that for the bazillionth time in a nice way is just like a kind of emotional labor that I'm really like out of energy for. And that is the thing that I need to do differently. And that like, I haven't like publicly messed that up yet, or like, maybe it's not messing it up. Maybe I haven't publicly confronted that fact yet, but like, I don't think anyone knows that that's where I'm at with it. But that has to be different. I have to feel differently about it. And like, the only thing that I think is going to be able to help me with that is some time and some space away. And I think like going forward after the Thanksgiving break, I'm just really hopeful that having that a little bit of time and a little bit of space away, I will be able to reset for myself on some of that and some of like the ways that I feel and the ways that my time is being managed. And then I'll also then be able to like help do that for teachers and just like provide a little more. I mean, and I don't think, I think they have had that kind of support. And I think that like, they know that they have and feel that they have. And I don't think they feel as imposed upon. But one of the like facts right now of this kind of work is like, it's hard for everybody, but also like, I don't have a boss. There's nobody. Like, when the thing has to be passed up, like at some point it stops, right? And like right now it's stopping here. And that is a huge, huge, huge failure because like, I'm not the answer to anybody's problem at this time. Like the answer is that there needs to be a childcare bailout and a rethinking of the role of education in American society. And the DOH needs to answer its phone and like all of these things. Like, I'm not the top of any of this system. Like, that's ridiculous, but I am the last person who will answer your phone call.
Yep. What's the DOH, Department of Housing? No.
Department of Health. The Department of Health and Mental Hygiene licenses early childhood programs in New York City, not state. And you asked about the budget. Do you want me to talk?
I was going to go there and yeah, I mean, I'm even debating, I'll kind of leave it up to you. You know, the first round of interviews for all of these, we were asking, or at least I was asking, really like, imagine it, you know, what do you imagine the future of education being? And, you know, first, if you don't mind talking about the, you know, the very practical reality of the budget, and then also in, you know, your imagination, because everything is not normal and like is kind of in reset mode. You know, what should happen after this? Like, where can education go that's probably different than what people talked about, you know, 6 months ago in their sort of like critiques of education? Like, actually now it's, you know, there's this moment of let's start over.
Right.
So, you know, what happens after this? But yeah, if you don't mind just taking me through some of the really practical, I don't know, numbers and what, you know, how seeing as you are in DOH, you know, and we don't know when resources are going to come to New York City or to anyone with children.
Right.
Yeah.
So, I mean, we are in the middle at RHP, we are in the middle of a 2 to 3 month process. It's usually a 1 to 2 month process of like discussing and debating what the tuition increase will be for the coming school year. And so, and the way that we make that decision is by approving a budget, and like the budget, the projected budget includes the tuition, the projected tuition revenue at like X, Y, or Z percent. And so, you know, we've been really like having this conversation on a big scale of like, what are the, you know, this is the first year probably in the life of the school, certainly in the time that I've been privy to the budget and long before, this is the first time that we won't be breaking even, you know, and we're not for profit. So like we don't, when we make like, when there's income in excess of expenses, it goes to tuition assistance or to like, you know, a sort of general like surplus. It's not a profit that we like pay out in bonuses or anything like that. But, you know, we've always like tried to operate and like charge what it costs to run our program and to, you know, have some budget that we can use for financial aid and good PD and competitive salaries for our teachers. But like, you know, who knows what that means, but like, you know, industry standard salaries for our teachers and all of these things. We are definitely not having that this year. Not close. That primarily has to do with, you know, a precipitous drop in enrollment, which is like us and every other private school in the country. And that's okay for us. We had enough, we have some enough cushion that like, if this was going to be a 1 year problem, it would be like, eh, well, we didn't have a good year financially. We did have a good year. And like one of the things that we really, one of the ways that we talked as a board, as the leadership of the school, the governance of the school, about the decisions that we made financially in like March through July was like, if this is going to be the last year of RHP, let's make it really great. Like we have enough resources to make it the best school year we can make it. So like, let's not cut any teacher jobs. Let's invest in the materials we need. Let's reopen the tuition assistance application and meet the need of all families whose incomes were like directly and deeply affected, which we did. So nobody had to pull out of RHP if their commitment to RHP for financial reasons or like because they couldn't meet their first tuition commitment. And we didn't fire any teachers, which means that we're running on like 75-ish percent of what our normal enrollment would be. Many of those children are paying a lot less than they would have been paying because they're, you know, they're more tuition assisted than they would have been. And like, that's good. I feel really good about all of that. I'm really glad that that is the institution that we are. And that those are the decisions we made. I think they were absolutely right. I stand by them so much. I also like, as the leader of this institution, I'm like, we can't do that again forever. Like, it sucks that it looks as though this coming school year is going to be another year that is deeply affected by this. But we can't be deeply, deeply in the hole 2 years running and not at some point try to start charging tuition that covers the cost of running the program. Like that's not, you know, both because if you believe as I do that this is like important work, and that the fixed costs are fixed. The only place that that comes from is salaries. Like if you're, that's the only place. And so that either means you know, you have fewer teachers, which is shitty and is terrible for the program and is terrible for morale, and also means that families are going to be getting a, like, for lack of a better word, product that is of you know, significantly decreased quality. Or you charge what it costs, right? And then families absorb that. And we're, you know, we're lucky in that we already have, we have an existing tuition assistance program. So the families of ours who couldn't absorb that necessarily would have the potential to not. And the families who can, which is probably most of them ultimately, will be paying more, and that will cover what it costs. But like, that's not right. I mean, it shouldn't be that it's families and schools on an individual decision-making basis. Like, that's not right. And it's not right that a school like mine, which is, you know, predominantly white and predominantly middle class and in, you know, a sort of specific area of Brooklyn where everyone is a freelancer and most people have parents they can call to help pay the grandkids' tuition for a year or two, you know, like, even if they're a freelancer and their income was really affected, like, somebody in their family has that money. And like, it can get to them eventually without any, like, doing any real damage to the long-term viability of that family's financial situation. And it's not fair that then we get to make so much better choices, or like, to spread it to, you know, we could do an 8% increase over 2 years, or, you know, like 8 and 8 or whatever, where a program that had no reserves has to do a 20 right now, you know, because like, there's no more money. So I think those are the kinds of conversations we're having. We're having a conversation at the board level that I'm finding really interesting about like families and goodwill. And like, are families going to feel that a tuition increase of, you know, 10 to 15 to 20%, which again, like, would not cover the loss that we have taken. Like, would still be the school absorbing some loss. But that such a large tuition increase would feel like an insult in a year like this, in which so many people have been hit so hard. And that is the thing I have been ruminating a lot on in terms of like the push and pull between, like, for a school positioned as we are, that is somewhere like between capitalism and socialism, where like, it's a capitalist business that like can only survive if it makes money and is worth money and employs people and buys things and pays rent and like is fully within that system. And then also people feeling as though they have to like feel good about the cost of it. And like, that it should be provided, that the pricing of it should be a goodwill decision. Where it's just like, that's not what it costs to run it. Like, you don't expect, you know, when you go to the supermarket or like to buy your clothes, that the price is going to be set to make you feel good. Like, the price is going to be set so that like the thing can keep doing it, you know, so that the machine can keep moving. And like, that means that you like, you know, and whatever you believe about like capitalism and the way that workers are treated and whatever, like, you have to be able to pay the people who do the work to keep doing the work, or there's no more work. Like, and I'm like so mystified at the same time that these uber liberal families are like, the teachers, and are they okay, and how are they, and what can we do for them, and how are they feeling, and da, 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 da. I'm like, well, they didn't get a, you know, salary increase this year, and you know, and they're really tired. And like, we do have this wonderful family support community, and they're amazing. And I think that like, they are people, you know, there are people who read my emails and like when I do the work to say the thing nicely and explain why like a 15% tuition increase is necessary to making sure that our teachers continue to be compensated fairly for the work that they're doing in a drastically altered industry landscape, like they'll get it. But I'm just like, you have to have your hand held through it. Like, figure it out. Like, it's so obvious. It's so obvious. It's like so plain to me. And I think that like there's a real, there's an appetite for it, but it's also like, it shouldn't be an appetite. It should be this obvious to everybody that this is like women's work that has been historically undervalued, that is mostly done by women of color, that like somehow you have been convinced, even as a like liberal and well-meaning and like right-thinking person, that somehow you have to feel good about how much it costs to run this program. It's like, you don't, you should be really pissed and you should vote that way. You should be voting and advocating and like seeing so clearly that this is something that should be entirely government funded and of high quality and available to everyone, and that it can be because they do it in Scandinavia.
Sorry for looking around. There are a lot of noises coming from my living room. So,
do you know what's in your living room?
I'm hoping it's my roommate, but it was
good.
Really loud. So it sounded like something crashed.
Oh, no. You can take a minute if you need to.
Yeah, let me just, I'm sorry to do this.
No, you're fine.
You know, it's like weird. Yeah, I mean, you've already said there's no more line between being at home and being, so just 1 second.
Yeah, sure.
Okay, everything is cool out there. Let me ask you, because we are coming up on the end, and I really appreciate your time and your thoughts and your reflections. I mean, it's, and I'm also so, so happy that Suzanne is doing this project, because it, you know, everyone is trying to capture the experiences of health workers and essential, you know, workers who are working in health, and it's like, you know, education and the school system in general is going through such an intense transformation. And it is only through doing this that, you know, it really is like phase by phase put into the record. So thanks for doing this, even though you must be exhausted and it's more having to be nice after the end of the work today.
This is not me being nice. Oh, okay.
Oh, well then, I can't imagine what you being nice is. Yeah, I mean, is there anything else that you want to say just to put it out there for now? And I don't know what comes next in terms of this project, but anything else you want to be captured for the record for now, or just anything to add?
Think so. No, I think. I think I've said what I think right now. And I'm so grateful for these. They're so like, I'm so excited for the record and for the thing to exist, but it's also been for me like such a really helpful opportunity at like important moments to just stop and be like, what do you actually think?
Yeah.
So thank you for that.
Just just a vehicle. It's actually very, I teach at the university level, and it's actually been the same for me, because I mean, hearing everyone that I have spoken to, I'm taking mental notes in addition to listening very carefully. So it's been exactly the same experience for me.
It's really good. It's really good. It's so like, I wish people could have like an hour and a half to do anything. And like,
it's pretty profound, you know, it's like a closing for the record.
Oh my God. We are going to be a really traumatized group on the other end. All right.
Well, thank you so much. I hope you eat something nice, and I hope you get 5 days off for Thanksgiving, but I'll settle for 3. That sounds good too.
Thank you so much, Anna. Thank you for doing this. It was nice to talk to you.
Nice to connect. Nice to talk to you.
Bye. Take care. Be well.
You too.